Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Since his 1996 debut, George Saunders has established himself as a master of the short story. A distinctive voice, that odd blend of the horrific and the humorous. His new collection is called 10th of December, and the New York Times has already proclaimed that it is the best book you'll read this year. George Saunders, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
I was planning on reading War and Peace later this year.
No, actually, the plan is nobody will read anything else, and then we'll make that come true.
It's a remarkable collection of stories, and I want to start with something that you said in conversation with your editor, Andy Ward, in Slate. You said, "Realism is to fiction what gravity is to walking, a confinement that allows dancing under the right circumstances."
That's kind of nifty, isn't it?
How long did it take you to come up with that?
My work is often discussed in terms of realism versus absurdism. And my experience of life has been that that's kind of a meaningless distinction.
Right.
You know, if you get into a weird enough place, realism isn't adequate to describe it. So I think when we're reading, there are certain kind of rules of engagement that almost any reading mind would respond to. So, for example, detail is a good one. Velocity is a good one. A moment that makes the reader lean in with a kind of, oh yeah, that's happened to me kind of feeling is a good one. We tend to call those things, we tend to associate those things with realism.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's just like gravity. Gravity isn't good or bad. It doesn't have a lot of opinions, but it just is. And whatever you're doing in the physical realm, you have to take it into account.
Yeah. So is that something that you need to be aware of as a storyteller, or is it simply just like gravity? You don't even think about it. It just is.
I think the former, because sometimes I think, certainly when I was a young writer, I thought I could work around those things or maybe that innovation meant ignoring them. But then you sort of find out that the form is what it is, the mind is what it is. So if you want, it's almost like the first required job is to get the reader paying attention.
Mm.
Then all the other stuff can happen. So in some ways, it's a very sort of traditional deal. You know,
Now, what about, do you look for the same sort of thing in songwriting, in some of the songs you've picked for us today?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I picked them partly because I wasn't a big reader as a young person. Kind of maybe some genre stuff, but not a literary
You mean
person.
Like sci-fi and that sort
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, or Ayn Rand, or mm-hmm. even just a lot of books like World's Greatest Fighter Pilots, that kind of
okay.
thing. Yeah. So I wasn't a big reader, but at that time in high school, I was getting a lot of aesthetic buzz from music, of course. So then only the last couple of years I've realized how influential some of these early songs were in defining for me what a story could be or should be. So I was kind of a bright enough kid, but a little lazy. But these in Chicago in the 70s, FM radio was really vibrant. So you'd hear kind of a mainstream rock piece, and then something by Segovia, Leo Kottke, and then so it was a great way to kind of get your cultural awareness boosted up just by sitting there listening.
Wow. Yeah. And you, the New York Times article where they say that, 10th of December is the best book you'll read this year.
Say it again.
They have this picture of you with the Fender Telecaster, the electric guitar, the Johnny Winter hair. Mm-hmm. You said something to the effect that, we all, during the course of our lives, we have different, we're all different people at different times. Who were you back then? Tell us about the George Saunders who was the wannabe jazz fusion guitarist.
I was a kid who I was not going to go to college, had no interest in it. And there's a guy in my high school who was a fantastic guitar player. And he said, "We're going to have a band." And he said, he actually knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody in the Eagles. And so the thing was,
So you were set.
I was all set. Why did I have to go to college? But he said something like, I've gotten in with these guys. We'll be the opening act for the opening act. And now that's funny, except that I do remember going into a music store with him and buying a PA, and he had a check for $10,000 from somebody. So I really don't know what was going on there. But I read Atlas Shrugged, actually, and that made me think about college. I don't know how I had this romantic image of myself strolling through a campus in what I thought of as a college sweater, you know. So I quit the band. But at that point, I was doing a lot of, you know, my parents were great, and they let me set up my stuff in the front room. So I'd put on Ted Nugent and jam along, or the Allman Brothers, and, you know. So that. Yeah.
Well, now you mentioned Chicago, which is, I guess, where you grew up.
Yes.
The first song that you've picked for us comes from Steve Goodman.
Right.
Well-known Chicago Cubs fan, the guy
yes.
who wrote the song Dying Cubs Fan's
right.
Last Request. I mean, he's most famous for having written City of New Orleans,
right.
which was a big hit for Arlo Guthrie. Strangely, though, you have picked a song that Steve Goodman did not write.
That's right. It was written by a guy named Mike Smith. And one of the kind of interesting stories is that many, many years later, when I was really struggling to write my first book, I was getting kind of desperate, you know. And this guy, Mike Smith, did a songwriting seminar in Rochester in some guy's living room. Like, he paid $50, and he was a brilliant talker about writing. And he said something that really changed my whole trajectory. He said, what you do is you write a song, then play it on your recording, then listen to your hero. And he said, for example, Dylan. And everybody groaned. Ugh. He said, no. He said, if you have the impulse that your work sucks, that is so great because it means you still have taste. Yeah, and then he said, and that feeling of revulsion or disappointment that you have is what will lead you, because all you have to do is look honestly at it and say, okay, how is it falling short? Mm-hmm. And somehow that got in my head, and it was a very hopeful kind of a thing. So, but anyway, Steve Goodman, when I grew up in the South Suburbs, and my dream as a kid was to go to Old Town, hang out at one of those clubs, and then have Steve Goodman instantly, just by looking at me, recognize me for the guitar virtuoso I was, and then say, hey, kid, I need a, you know. So that never happened, but I just love the song. So.
All right. The author, George Saunders, is with us. His new collection is called 10th of December, and he's made up a little playlist for us, beginning with The Dutchman from Steve Goodman.
The Dutchman's not the kind of man who keeps his thumb jammed in the dam that holds his dreams in. That's a secret only Margaret knows. When Amsterdam is golden in the summer, Margaret brings him breakfast she believes in. He thinks tulips bloom beneath the snow. He's mad as he could be. Margaret only sees that sometimes. Sometimes she sees her unborn children in his eyes. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Zuider Zee. Long ago, I used to be a young man. Dear Margaret, remember.
Just a little bit of The Dutchman from Steve Goodman. A song written by Mike Smith and popularized by the late Steve Goodman. And the author George Saunders, his latest book is 10th of December. He's here with us in the Soundcheck studio sharing a playlist with us on the program today. Let me ask you about 10th of December. You're an unrepentant music fan.
I am.
Do you consider 10th of December in a way to be a concept album?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as somebody who grew up in the 70s, I used to take so much pleasure in, you know, laying out the album art and kind of analyzing why the songs were in the order they are. And actually, on this one, I tend to work by having a pretty good idea of what's going in at some point, then laying them all out. And then the trick is to try to figure out the order so that the collection kind of tells an Uber story, you know, in addition to the individual. So I got a little lost. And my daughter actually said to me, Dad, just think of it like an album. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, I don't know, put the good one, the best one first and last, and make sure that nothing, there's not too long of a stretch of suckiness in the middle. You know? So, and that was right, you know. So I think that's kind of part of your job is to, you're doing the individual stories, and then in the ordering, you can kind of tell a very subtle secondary story.
Now, people who read The New Yorker will already be familiar with some of the stories, and the Spiderhead story, the one about the sort of futurist dystopian pharmaceutical experiments.
Yeah.
There is a kind of an echo of that. much later in the book,
right.
In the story, My Chivalric Fiasco.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was that sort of intended? Were you supposed to sort of think back to the earlier story?
Yes, hopefully. But also, since no one will, this isn't radio and I can just say it.
It is radio, in fact.
Oh, well, I'll say it anyway. that story actually...
What did you think this was?
I thought I was just hanging out. What the hell? I was wondering why the headphones are on. No, but that story actually dropped out of The Spider. I had that in there as a riff where, the idea that a drug could change the diction of the speaker.
Right.
But it didn't fit in that one, but I kind of like this. So sometimes I'll just let something fall off and say, okay, go make your own room now.
So it's an outtake.
It's an outtake. It's a revamped outtake.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So do you have a lot of that sort of thing lying around the office?
Not at the moment, but usually, yeah. Yeah, I think it's, I have the sense that a story exists pretty platonically perfect in your mind, but sometimes in telling it, you drop it and it shatters. So part of the rewriting process to try to recobble that original version. And in the process, your mind will sometimes actually weirdly crossfire and give you something from another story. So my sense is if I'm writing something and it doesn't go in, if it's got good energy, I just set it aside and say, I'm sorry I got you in the wrong story. Stay there and I'll try to use you later.
Well, now, in music, the completest fan always wants to hear the musician's outtakes.
Right,
We want to hear those alternate versions, the original demos. We want to hear all of that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Would you ever share these, these sort of set aside things if they don't actually find their own?
I had a period a few years ago where I did, and then something about it didn't feel quite right. I think in some ways, at the highest level as an artist, you're responsible for the best version, the tightest version, and. So if you do something good and it doesn't get in, that's okay. As Faulkner said, cut your darlings and, let them go.
And as your daughter said, try not to have too much suckiness in the middle.
That's a mantra for all of us artists. Don't suck.
We're speaking with George Saunders, the author. His latest release is 10th of December, a collection of his short stories. And you brought in, you played for us this Steve Goodman song. The next song that you picked is a guy who was long associated with Steve Goodman.
Yeah, I hoped that him and Steve would be together at this thing when they recognize me.
This is John Prine
that we're
talking about. Yeah. So, you had this kind of jazz fusion thing happening in the 70s, but the singer-songwriter thing was certainly lurking somewhere as well.
Yeah, actually, in the 70s, it was more that. And when I got to college, I got into a sort of Return to Forever type clone band. Yeah, but I this song, I always loved it because it's so sort of frankly political and it doesn't make any apologies and it's funny. And, of course, it was the early 70s. So I remember the song Chicago by Graham Nash or some stuff by Kansas that was just kind of overtly political. Oh, the other thing that was always powerful for me was on the first Chicago album, there's an outtake, a recorded outtake from the convention riot. And my friend and I, who is equally political, used to listen to it over and over. And it was kind of like the music is building and you hear these two guys who sound like Cheech and Chong kind of. And one guy goes, "Let's get out of here, man." And then suddenly you hear the police are upon them. So there's something growing up outside of Chicago, knowing that all the stuff was going on just a few miles away was very kind of politicizing. So this song, the first time I heard it, I just thought it was great.
It's John Prine from 1971, and the song is "Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore."
While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of the dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on the window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
A little bit from John Prine from 1971, his song Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore.
Still relevant.
That idea that your art and your political engagement, that you as a person, as an artist, you're still the person who is, you know, either politically engaged or not.
Right.
And that is also a part of who you
exactly.
are and what you
yeah.
do.
You know, I always think there's a Chekhov story called Grief, and for me that's a real touchstone, because often people say, well, does politics belong in writing and so on? And that story is, there's no overt politics, but it's just a man whose son has died that day, but he's sort of a cab driver with, you know, horse-drawn carriages. And all day long, all he wants is for someone to listen to him, and nobody will. He's a nobody. And at the very end of the story, he steps into the stable and he just puts his head against the horse's snout and says, I had a son. He's dead now. You know. So yeah. Is that a political story? Well, yeah, kind of, you know, given what will happen in Russia in 10 or 15 years.
Right.
But also it's all kept within the personal and the real.
And some of your stories. I mean, there's one tale in 10th of December of, you know, a guy who comes back from war. There was a guy in the gym today who came in full army fatigues, and I almost said, thanks for your service, which becomes this kind of catchphrase that everybody's saying to this guy after he comes in the story, after he comes back from war. And everyone's saying it, and no one's really meaning it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing political anywhere in that story.
Right, right.
But it is a political
act, right.
The act
you
of
know,
writing that.
Right. I think if you imagine that a person in his or her wholeness and mental health is absolutely subject to outside forces. So, you know, if suddenly a person is unemployed and destitute, their grace is going to suffer. And so, therefore, the personal and the political are... You know, I did a piece for GQ a couple years ago where I lived in a homeless camp for 2 weeks, or 1 week, incognito. Seemed like 9 weeks. But that was a really great reminder of just this thing, because the politics of that situation are incredibly complicated and dark, you know, sort of the underbelly of America. All manifesting in personal stuff, like a young woman who literally had been hit by a train. She had a gangrenous foot, and she's a crackhead, mm-hmm. and she's living in a tent. You know, so personal, political. What's the difference?
Yeah, we're speaking with the author George Saunders. His latest collection is called 10th of December, and George is sharing a playlist with us on Soundcheck today. A little bit later on in the show, we'll have live music from the band Ra Ra Riot. Their new album is called Beta Love, and it's got this kind of futurist theme to it. You know, William Gibson, the cyberpunks, Ray Kurzweil, the futurist writer. You have a little, you know, there's certainly a kind of futurist element that has been in a lot of your stories.
Sure.
And for you, Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, that was another touchstone.
It was, yeah. And it was one that I came to early and didn't get. I'd heard that it was set in World War II, and he'd been there. And I was a big Hemingway guy. So the first time I read it, I thought, God, Kurt, you wasted it. You know, there's spaceships in this. And then many years later, when I tried writing myself, and also when I kind of been knocked around a bit by life, I came back to it. And then it seemed to me like this masterpiece of understatement and minimalism that was, for me then, you know, much more powerful than anything I ever read about war.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the understatement of Kurt Vonnegut. I was looking for a word earlier today to try and capture the tone that seems to run through all of the stories in 10th of December, and the one I hit on was understated. And a lot of the music that you've picked for us has a certain understated quality as well, right. Although perhaps not this next song.
Probably not.
Tell us about, I'll hazard a guess here, the Dejurik sisters.
Dejurik sisters, yeah. They're, all I know about them is they were, I think, from the 30s, somewhere out west, and they had this extraordinary talent, which we'll hear. But I use this, I teach at Syracuse, and I use this in a little mini class on escalation, which to me is one of the prime skills in storytelling. You have to get the water to boil. And so when we talk about this song, we play it five or six times, and we talk about the way that an element gets introduced and then is absolutely not allowed to sit there statically. Well, I'll give it away. If a yodel comes in, just say, then the yodeling is going to escalate. And since they bring to the table this idea of weird sounds, the weird sounds are going to escalate. So nothing is allowed to sort of flatline. Everything has to be constantly headed upwards.
This is called The Arizona Yodeler from 1938 and the Dejurik Sisters.
How I know now where the folks you meet all know a thing or two. They lived a lad of great ambition, who had set as his life's mission to excel upon his ability today. And he'd play a little tune on his Spanish guitar. He'd mingle with a song, the sweet refrain. In the evening in the cactus, he would get a lot of practice on his yodeling. As the cattle he was trailing, you would always hear him wailing on his yodeling. Once a big shot from the city heard him warbling the ditty, and accompanied with oodle-dee-da-da. Then he said, "Look here, my sonny, you can make a lot of money with the oodle-dee-da-da."
And it gets crazy. Right?
Holy cow!
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's—I guess that's what they did. They just yodeled. That's.
George Saunders picking the hits for us on Soundcheck today. His latest release is a collection of his short stories called 10th of December. He's sharing his playlist with us, which includes that 1938 Arizona Yodeler from the DeJurek Sisters. Man, that's what do your students at Syracuse make of that?
Well, I played it the first time, and the looks were just shocked, you know. And then as we, you know, and it's really interesting to watch them because almost any human being listening to that song will get a little giddy at the end because it just keeps going, and you say, "What are they doing?" So I mean, to me, that, you know, part of storytelling, maybe in teaching in the academic setting, it's easy to lose sight of this, that you're really trying to delight somebody, you're trying to kick somebody's butt and kind of surprise them. So if you keep that as the main goal, the Zurich sisters are kind of a nice role models.
And it just occurs to me, mentioning Syracuse University, our musical guest, Ra Ra Riot. All from Syracuse.
Really?
All from Syracuse University. It's where they met. I'm sure that will come up in our conversation. George, do you listen to music while you write?
No, never, never. It's for the same reasons I don't drink while I write. I think you're trying to make an intimate connection with this person that you don't know. So I think for me, a flat aspect, you know, as the writer is best. So your perceptions aren't being altered in any way. And when I was younger and I listened to music, you know, you could type up the phone book, and if you're listening to the Pogues, it's very moving, you know. But unfortunately, you can't count on the fact that the reader's listening to the Pogues. So I don't. Sometimes what I will do, though, is, you know, I find that to write, it helps me to be just a little happy, just a little happy. So if I'm not feeling it, I'll drive into town on an errand and put something in. And lately, the Wilco, that beautiful song, One Sunday Morning, it's just an epic. And I listen to that, and I'm ready to go, you know. But then it has to go off before I start typing.
This is how I tell it. Oh, but it's long. One Sunday morning. Oh, one sun is gone.
Speaking with George Saunders, his new album.
Yes, I've been waiting to hear that all my life.
Well, we did talk about how 10th of December, your new collection of stories, is like a concept album. So, yeah, there you go. You're welcome.
His new album
is called 10th of December. The New York Times says it's already the best book you'll read this year. I have certainly enjoyed reading it, and George has been sharing his playlist with us on the program of mostly older material. What have you been listening to recently?
Well, I have two daughters who are, you know, big music fans, so they kind of keep me a little bit. So this next one is Middle Brother, who I'd never heard of before, and Grace. But you know, Wilco, Elliot Smith is somebody who I just go deeper and deeper with him. Also, you know who I really love is John Adams, the composer, and his piece on the Transmigration of Souls, which I've only listened to three times because I'm reduced to a puddle of weeping every time.
That's the work that he wrote for the New York Philharmonic for the first anniversary of the 9/11 attacks.
Right, right. Yeah. Really moving. And you know, I think I don't know. I tend to listen to music almost to sort of press a button that I know exists. So if I go to listen to, say, the Allman Brothers or whoever it is, I kind of know what I want. But with Adams, I love coming to his pieces fresh without any preconceptions, and then he always manages to to move me and kind of wake me up a little bit.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary composer, Pulitzer Prize winner. But Middle Brother, this is something you got from one of your daughters?
Yeah, she sent me a little CD, and this song, again, this is, I think, such a beautiful piece of writing because kind of a simple idea gets introduced, and then pop, 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 three little manifestations.
That escalation you were talking
about? Yeah, very simple, very original. And also the way that some of the lines come out are so clever and sweet.
Yeah, we'll hear a little bit from this band called Middle Brother. We've been speaking with the author, George Saunders. His new book is a collection called 10th of December. George, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you
really
for coming in.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
This is Soundcheck.
When it hits me that she's left me alone, when I finally move on with my life, her goodbye written into stone, and her shadow grown into a night. It's me.